The Heaven Field, a novel by I.G. Hume, read by the author. Episode 13, Between Worlds. Thomas glanced anxiously at his watch. He felt as if he were being torn in two. On the one hand, this was the first time since his studies at the university where he had the opportunity to have a full-on discussion about so many aspects of standing point theories. He was amazed at the depth of Grace's knowledge, and was swept along with her boundless energy. He found himself at her whiteboard, drawing wild diagrams and equations, and in an instant Grace would erase them all with a flourish of a cloth, and frantically scribble down her own burst of creativity. Thomas felt giddy with energy, and drunk on possibilities, but at the back of his mind he thought excitedly of Susan. Would she be waiting for him in the concourse? He had said that he would only be an hour at most. There was a knock at the door. Grace stopped scribbling on the board, her train of thought broken. She looked up at Thomas as if she had been awoken from a spell. She grinned madly. "Come in," she called. Jane Honeyman stuck her head around the door. She saw Thomas and her face dropped. "Well, what is it, Jane?" asked Grace, studying a sheet of Thomas's notes. "Commander James has been trying to reach you on the phone," said Jane, not moving from the doorway. "Oh yes, I unplugged it," explained Grace absent-mindedly, then turned to Thomas. "This here is of real interest," she said. "He says you have a meeting with him half an hour ago," said Jane. "He's a little, animated." Grace sighed and dropped her notes to the desk. "Yes, yes, thank you, Jane. I'm sorry, Thomas," she said as Jane shut the door behind her. "Can we get together again tomorrow? I've got a bit of a full schedule today." Thomas nodded in relief. 5 minutes later, he was running down the corridor towards the concourse.
"Grace, I've been trying to get in contact with you. Where have you been?" asked James as he showed Dr. Palmer into his office. "Oh, I've just had an amazing talk with the new boy, Sullivan. That kid is incredible. Just wait to hear what I have to tell you about the Heaven Field, Colin. Oh, a few simple tests. If he's right, my God, it's revolutionary."
Grace stood in the middle of the room, gesticulating wildly, full of enthusiasm.
Grace, calm down. Just what are you talking about?" sighed James. "I've had Detective Scott shouting down the telephone at me for the past hour. You were supposed to be organising the personnel lists, the accident reports, blueprints, schematics, etc. Need I go on?"
Grace stopped and seemed to visibly deflate.
"There is no more project, Grace. Face facts. We must cooperate with the authorities. Try and salvage at least something out of all of this."
He slumped down into a chair with his head in his hands. Grace sat down next to him, a solemn expression on her face.
"We were so close," she whispered. "That boy could have revolutionised the way we understand the field. The things we could have achieved."
Her voice tailed off to an awkward silence.
"So close," echoed James sadly. "Is there anything a layman might understand?"
he asked, smiling wearily to himself. Grace looked at him and opened her mouth. Her expression was suddenly animated, as she prepared to spill out her excitement. She paused for a second and sighed.
"Oh, I don't know," she said with a shrug. "It's just the boy thinks he can prove where the field exists."
She pulled a cigarette packet from out of her lab coat pocket and cursed to find it empty.
"And does he have any idea of where that might be?" asked James impatiently, unable to wait while Grace searched her clothes for an elusive cigarette. "Oh, all around us," she said matter-of-factly, and grinned as she discovered the battered remains of a cigarette in her top pocket.
"Have you got a light?" she asked.
"What do you mean, Grace?" asked James in frustration, his curiosity aroused by Grace's unusually straightforward replies.
Grace sighed, as if explaining herself to an infant.
"Well, as opposed to travelling through the field, to another place, Tim thinks we are actually travelling into the field. So, it is in actuality, and very crudely put, an energy level into which our excited particle states are shifted."
She hunted her pockets again for a lighter.
"An energy level," muttered James. "So, a different spectrum, like infrared or something. Bingo, she exclaimed, pulling out a dusty lighter from her trouser pocket and lighting her cigarette. Just think of the possibilities, she sighed. Exploring the world afresh, travelling the world within our world. So what you were saying, asked James, scratching his head, is that the world of the field corresponds to our world. As we travel through the field, we could be moving through this world too. A curious expression was beginning to form on James's face. Why, yes, said Grace, looking quizzically at the big man. Theoretically, Tom, was thinking that using a resonant state and some means of controlling it, well, one could shift out of the field spectrum and so on, once one has been excited by the accelerator array, of course. She stopped. James had a peculiar look of realization on his face. Oh my, he whispered. That's how. He stared long and hard at Grace. Grace, is there any possible way that someone could use the array without us knowing? You know the answer to that, Colin, she replied, with an expression of confusion. It takes 200 people over 6 hours to prepare the array. Just what are you thinking? James took a deep breath and began. I received a telephone call today. I had asked a friend of mine at the Home Office to dig up some details on the Lambert assassination, to see if there's any clue as to why someone would want to stop this project. It seems there were several unusual features attached to the murder. Firstly, there was absolutely no sign of forced entry or exit, even with Professor Lambert's security. Secondly, around the body was a scattering of red dust. Grace suddenly felt sick to her stomach. Go on, she whispered quietly. I managed to get the results of the lab tests on the dust. Grace was as white as a ghost. She knew what was coming. Patty, she croaked. They were a perfect match with the results from her autopsy, he sighed. Whoever was in that room, committing that murder, they had been in the field. That's what they are using to move around in, undetected. Do you realise what this means, Grace? We have no defence against this. But it was just dust, murmured Grace, unable to take it all in. Surely it could be a mistake. Well, that's the other thing, said James, looking grim. I'm sorry I couldn't tell you this earlier, Grace. I really am. And I shouldn't be saying it now, but... He breathed deeply. The dust. Well, it wasn't just dust. It was blood. It's all dried blood. I'm sorry I'm late, gasped Thomas, upon finding Susan sat on the low marble wall that surrounded the fountain. She was smoking a roll-up and had one shoe off, dipping her toes in the water. Oh, hi, Thomas, she smiled upon seeing him. That's okay. Shall we get going? A quarter of an hour later, they emerged into the low golden sunlight. The sun was warm, but the air felt icy. Susan led Thomas off down the bustling road, through avenues of low grey buildings. A squad of soldiers jogged past them, their breath forming great clouds of vapour above them. The rhythmic crunch of their boots died away into the distance. They reached the training fields, walking in silence. Thomas had never been this far before, and was savouring the crisp, clean air and the feel of grass under his feet. I've only seen daylight a few times in the last couple of weeks, he sighed. You should get out more, said Susan. I love wandering about the edges of the base. Is there much of it? Asked Thomas. I thought it was just those grey buildings, isn't it? You'll see, smiled Susan. They were approaching a line of bare trees, which rose steadily upwards. Thomas could see dark moors in the distance beyond. Susan led him up a small dirt track between the trees. It was muddy and she climbed slowly and steadily. Thomas slipped along after her, awkward and ungainly compared to her light tread. There, what do you think? She smiled at last, panting from the exertion of the climb. Thomas looked about him. They had broken out of the trees and had a perfect view for miles around. Back, the way they had come from, was the base spreading out into the distance. He hadn't realised just how large it was, with squat buildings covering the floor of the low valley. Beyond the base he could make out a town in the distance, and the sun glinting off a long lake.
Thomas turned back towards Susan, and behind her the ground fell away again, to form another narrower valley. A babbling stream flowed swiftly down amongst the trees, which opened out onto a large ornamental garden. The stream fed an oval lake thick with dead leaves, and spanned by an arched bridge at its far end. Beyond the lake and garden stood an imposing manor house in some state of disrepair.
"Come on," said Susan excitedly, leading him off down an overgrown brick path which ran alongside the stream.
Soon they were out of the trees, and Thomas followed Miss Moran onto the narrow bridge, walking cautiously up to the middle.
"It's quite safe," she called cheerfully from the centre of the arch. "At least I think it is."
They looked down into the murky waters below them. Thomas saw movement, and a huge golden fish swam lazily to the surface, then darted away with a splash.
"What is this place?" he whispered, gazing at the huge sprawling building beyond the gardens.
"That's Maunsworth House," replied Susan, wrapping her jacket around her against the chill of the air. "It was a military base during the Second World War. They did a lot of electronics research there, communication stuff, I think. There's a book about it in the library." She smiled.
"Is it empty now?" asked Thomas, as he peered at the rows of dark, lifeless windows.
"Yes, the base expanded into the other valley. Then they stopped using here when everything went underground. Do you want to have a look around?" she asked with a grin.
Are we allowed?" stuttered Thomas.
"Who's to know?" laughed Susan.
"I've been in a couple of times. It's a bit spooky."
Okay, said Thomas, none too convinced. Susan led him through the overgrown gardens and up to the front of the manor house.
"There's a broken window round the back," she said cheerfully, and headed off down the side of the building, a high crumbling wall opposite creating a narrow alley.
As they picked through the weeds and pieces of fallen masonry, Susan stopped, cocking her head as if to listen.
"Did you hear that?" she asked, turning to Thomas, who shook his head.
"Must have been the ghosts," she grinned, and carried on to the end of the alley, whistling a tune to herself.
Here we are," she said, upon finding a small set of steps leading down to a boarded-up door.
A low window, close to ground level, stood ajar, with two panes of glass broken. Susan knelt down and pulled it fully open, brushing away a few shards of glass from the frame. She ducked in through the opening and was gone. Thomas stood anxiously outside, not quite knowing what to do. He thought he heard a banging noise from somewhere nearby, possibly inside the house. Susan poked her head back out through the window.
"Come on,"
she said, grinning like a Cheshire cat. Thomas peered in through the opening. It looked dark and ominous. He struggled over the sill and found his footing over the other side. He was stood on a dusty work surface in what looked like an old laundry room. Susan helped him down, and he felt how soft her hand was. She smiled again and nodded to some stairs leading up into the heart of the dark building. Grace sat in silent horror as James watched her intently.
"So, all the dust during the storm in the field, that was all blood too?" asked Grace incredulously. "What the hell's going on, Colin?"
James sighed.
"I'm just trying to make sense of it all myself, Grace, though I don't suppose we'll ever find out if they do shut us down. But one thing we know is that somebody is working against us to try and destroy the base and the Standing Point project, although it does seem as if we have done their work for them and brought that result upon ourselves."
He gave Grace a bleak smile.
"But we know they have appeared from the field, so we must conclude that they have an array system of their own."
"Or they inhabit the field and want to prevent us from reaching them,"
Grace cut in, looking animated once more.
"My God," breathed James, "I hadn't considered that. But they did have help from inside. Somebody recruited Danelle to plant the explosive, which I'm guessing now would have been brought in from the field under our very noses. Jesus, we just can't defend ourselves against this. They could appear anywhere."
"Do you still think Dan wasn't working alone?" asked Grace anxiously.
"I don't know," muttered James after a long pause. "We found explosives in places that he just wouldn't have had access to with his security clearance. It seems as if somebody higher up must have aided him. One of the team leaders, or a security coordinator or something."
"You think it's one of us?"
asked Grace in a panic.
I've known the team leaders for years. It couldn't be. Unless, oh my God, you don't suspect me, do you, Colin?
She was starting to get more hysterical.
No, no, Grace, calm down, please. I don't know what to think.
But there are other ways around security. He stood up and went over to a television in the corner of the room. He turned it on and pressed play on the video recorder.
My security staff sent me this yesterday. I didn't want to show it to you. I'm probably just being paranoid, but anyway.
The screen flickered into life, showing security camera footage from one of the buildings on the base. Grace thought it looked like the information centre. Two figures approached the reception desk. The quality of the picture was poor, but Grace instantly recognised the awkward gait of Thomas Sullivan.
Yesterday evening, at about 5:45, began James, Mr. Sullivan accessed our database systems for several files.
But I don't get it. He's got clearance. He's supposed to be researching that stuff,
she said, peering at the picture.
He is, replied James.
But she is not. He gestured to the screen as the picture changed, to reveal a woman sat at a terminal in the centre, whilst Thomas sat beside her.
Who is she?
Asked Grace, straining her eyes in an attempt to make her out.
Her name is Susan Moran, assistant librarian. She is accessing information to which he has denied clearance, using Sullivan's card.
You think Susan's a spy?
Asked Grace incredulously.
I've known Susan for years. She wouldn't hurt a fly. Besides, Sullivan turned up after all this began. She couldn't use his clearance to help Danelle.
No, but... Oh, I don't know, Colin sighed. I'm just concerned for Sullivan's safety. If all I hear is true, then he could be the key to our understanding of the field. I'm just glad he's got his bodyguard.
I don't see anyone with him in that film, said Grace. James looked up in concern.
Oh no, that's right. Do you think anything could have happened to him?
He said urgently, standing up.
Oh, relax, smiled Grace. I told you I saw him barely an hour ago. What trouble can he get into? He's not going to be far away from his books, is he?
They both laughed.
I'll keep an eye on Susan, she said solemnly.
Then once that young detective has finished with us, I don't think there will be much left for us to worry over.
Thomas followed Susan through the silent, dusty corridors into a huge derelict kitchen and back out through more dark, narrow hallways. She appeared to know where she was going, but Thomas was starting to get nervous in the rundown halls. There was a heavy silence, which seemed to take the sound of their footfalls and amplify them, sending echoes dancing away through the emptiness. Thomas's heart raced from a mixture of nervousness and excitement.
Here we are,
whispered Susan cheerfully.
Okay, now close your eyes,
she smiled, turning to Thomas.
I'm sorry,
he stuttered.
Come on, close your eyes, silly,
she teased. Thomas did so and held his hands out in front of him. He felt Susan's warm touch again as she led him by the hand. The sound of his footsteps changed as he walked from rotten, damp carpets onto bare floorboards. Suddenly his footsteps echoed, as if he were walking across a vast space. Susan let go of his hand.
Okay, you can open your eyes now, she said.
Thomas gasped at the scene before him. He was standing in the centre of a huge ballroom, looking out across the ornamental gardens through stained glass. Straight into the setting sun. The golden light burst in through the windows, melting into hundreds of different colours, and striking an enormous dusty chandelier, whose many crystals scattered the light about once more. Thomas gazed around in silent awe. He turned to smile at Susan. She was dappled with light of every hue. Exquisitely carved figures stood in alcoves along the walls behind her.
It's beautiful,
he breathed. And Susan grinned back. As he watched, the sun disappeared below the trees, and the light faded. A sudden sound of a slamming door instantly broke the moment. Thomas looked at Susan, as they distinctly heard the sound of footsteps walking high above them, moving towards the top of the stairs. Susan looked concerned for a second, and then grinned when she saw Thomas's terrified expression.
I think we better go,
she hissed, and pulled him back through a doorway. Thomas started off down the corridor, but it was much darker now, and he had trouble avoiding objects littering the floor. He looked behind him and realised Susan wasn't there. He dimly made out her outline, crouching at the door, which she had left ajar. Thomas crept back towards her, his heart in his mouth, just in time to glimpse two figures walk past the crack in the doorway. Susan was grinning up at him.
"I told you, it's probably just a cat or something," Thomas heard a gruff voice just beyond the doorway.
"Oh, come on, let's get back," said another voice, vaguely familiar to Thomas, but he couldn't place it.
He listened as the footsteps walked off away from them, and he breathed a sigh of relief. The door exploded inwards, and Susan screamed as she was knocked to the floor. Thomas dimly saw a dark figure silhouetted against the windows, before he was grabbed roughly by the collar and thrown to the ground beside Susan.
"Don't move!"
screamed a voice in his ear, and he felt a knee in his back pushing the air out of his lungs. Thomas was paralysed with fear as he felt cold metal touch the back of his neck and realised it was a gun. He shut his eyes in horror.
"Hands behind your head," commanded the voice again,
and Thomas complied instantly and felt himself being searched roughly. He felt his lapel badge torn from his jacket, then the weight lifted from his back, and he could breathe again. There was a silence which seemed to last an age. Then a calm, deep voice made Thomas sigh in relief.
"Could you roll over, please, sir?"
"Oh, Thomas, what are you doing here?" Sanders bent down and held his hand out to Sullivan as he holstered his pistol. He pulled Thomas to a sitting position where he sat wheezing in panic. Sanders looked at him in concern.
"Are you all right, sir? I'm so sorry, but you really shouldn't be here. This area is extremely off limits. Where's your escort?"
Thomas tried to reply, but he couldn't get the words out from his burning lungs.
"You just sit there and get your breath back," said Sanders anxiously.
Another man was kneeling next to Sanders, stooped over Susan. Thomas heard her moan as the man sat her up. She pressed herself back against the wall in fear.
"It's all right," gasped Thomas, crawling over to her.
She was wide-eyed and bleeding from a cut on her chin where the door had hit her.
"Do you think you can stand, miss?" asked Sanders gently.
She recoiled for a second, then shut her eyes and nodded, taking the big man's hand. He pulled her easily to her feet and steadied her while she got her balance. Thomas scrambled up beside her, coughing and spluttering.
"Metcalf, tell him it's all clear. Don't mention these two, though, okay?"
The other man looked quizzically at Sanders for a second, then shrugged, walking back into the hall, muttering into a radio. Sanders led Thomas and Susan, helping her to sit down on the stairs in the hall. He looked concernedly at the cut on her chin in the fading light. She winced as he touched it.
"It's not too deep, it won't need stitches. I'm very sorry I hurt you," he said gently, stepping back and regarding them both.
"Well, you should be sorry," muttered Susan in disgust. "We've got every right to be here." Sanders stared at them in silence, whilst Metcalf paced to and fro, looking at the view out of the window.
"May I ask what you're doing here?" asked the big man after a while.
Thomas stared guiltily at the floor.
"I just wanted to see the building," he muttered, getting his breath back. "We didn't know it was off limits."
"That's okay, Thomas. Nobody has been notified yet. It's not your fault. But I must ask for your assurance that you will not tell anybody about this."
"Why?" said Susan, getting angry. "Why shouldn't we?"
"Because you're already in a shitload of trouble," snapped Metcalf from the other side of the room.
Sanders held up his hand to calm him.
"It's all right, Thomas. Your clearance means that you'll be privy to the information about this area in due course. However, Miss Moran, is it? She would be in a good deal of trouble if it were known she were here. So I'm just asking for your word that you won't mention today's incidents, and that can be an end to it."
Thomas looked anxiously at Susan, who sighed and nodded her head.
Alex stood motionless, his hand tight around the grip of his gun. His mouth was dry and his legs felt like lead.
"Okay, everybody," he said grimly. "We've only got one chance at this, so let's make sure we do it right. Peter, commence the preliminary countdown."
Alex felt his body tingle, becoming lighter. He stared at Yuri and Chris. There was no turning back now. A jolt of pain shot through his head and he cried out, staggering to one side, clutching his temple.
"Alexei!" shouted Chris in concern.
Alex looked over to her and gasped. Dimly, as if viewing ghosts,
He could see the shapes of figures becoming apparent all around. This was a slow transition out of the field, which they would hopefully maintain long enough to find their targets. But something was wrong. Around the spectres of the military personnel, unaware they were being watched, were faint, glowing outlines, familiar grotesque shapes. Alex shook his head to try and clear his vision.
"Do you see them?"
he gasped in panic.
"Around the figures."
Chris and Yuri looked at him in concern, shaking their heads.
"I'm all right," he said at last. "Come on, we have to find the entrance to the underground facility."
They walked through the ghostly scene, following Ekristina, who regarded the map displayed on her small monitor panel.
"This way," she whispered.
It was a strange limbo to be in, thought Alex, trying to get used to being between two worlds. They walked over a large parade ground, where translucent military personnel marched to and fro. Yuri gasped as two soldiers walked straight through him, hurrying along, completely oblivious to the three. He gave an excited grin in spite of the danger. Alex found himself grinning back, despite the pain in his skull. It was a peculiar, voyeuristic feeling, passing amongst the world unawares. It felt powerful, almost godlike. Then his euphoria was lost as he noticed something dart around the two soldiers, a spindly, insect-like creature, lashing out at them with its claws. It was too faint and fast for Alex to get a good look at it, but something about it sickened him deeply. The two men carried on regardless, laughing and joking as they went, their voices distant as if underwater. Before Alex knew it, the alien figure was gone. Alex stared straight ahead, trying not to look around him in case he saw any more of these nightmares. He felt as if he was losing his sanity.
"Are you all right, sir?"
whispered Yuri at his side, as they approached the insubstantial grey outline of a building.
I'm fine,
hissed Alex through gritted teeth. A harsh burst of static filled his ears. Peter's concerned voice came over the radio, distant and distorted.
"You've got 15 minutes before the shield fails. You're going to have to get a move on."
"Okay," called back Chris. "We're approaching the underground entrance now. Alexei, what's wrong?"
Alex stood unmoving, staring dumbfounded at Chris, who had turned to see why he had stopped. Yuri looked on nervously. Around Ekristina's body, Alex saw the same familiar glow, so frightful to him now. But there was something subtly different about this light, and Alex found himself grinning uncontrollably. The haze around her was inexplicably pleasing to him, in a way which was becoming all too common now. As Alex concentrated on the glow, the shape of a figure slowly shifted into his vision. Gentle lines of soft, fine limbs became apparent, and Alex whispered to himself as the radiant creature revealed itself to Alex's eyes.
"It's beautiful,"
he breathed in awe.
"Alexei," barked Chris.
A pair of spiny, barbed limbs, abhorrent in their form, lashed out from nowhere into the ephemeral skin of the figure that surrounded her. The beautiful creature shielded itself from the attack, and great bloodless wounds appeared on its forearms. The malevolent creature gained in solidity as it struck swiftly, towering high above Chris. It was a bodiless form of long, bony limbs, some unspeakable nightmare made tangible. Its claws continued to whip out at Chris, and the ephemeral figure around her. With a great final swipe, it sliced a great wound into the beautiful being's delicate neck, and an ugly gash lolled open grotesquely. Light poured from the gouge like blood.
"Alexei!"
she shouted again. He looked around him, the horror cast on his face. The creatures were gone, and Ekristina was shaking him frantically, tears filling her eyes.
"Alexei, what's wrong? What's wrong?"
"We must abort the mission,"
croaked Alex in a panicked voice.
"Something terrible is happening."
"Abort? Alexei, we can't. We're so close now. We must see it through. We must."
Her face was full of concern, and she glanced anxiously at the readout on her monitor panel.
I'm cracking up," he stammered. "I'm seeing the visions nearly all the time now. I'm going the way of all the exposure victims. I'm going crazy."
He stumbled to his knees, dropping his heavy gun to the floor. Ekristina knelt down beside him.
"We're so close now, Alexei," she pleaded.
"I saw something terrible happen to you," he sobbed. "Everyone I know. I can't take it."
Chris looked shocked, but her jaw was stern.
"Alexei, I'm not afraid to die. We do this for the greater good. It's all right.
Now come on, we need you.
Alex looked into her green eyes, deep beneath the luminous goggles of her face mask. He nodded his head shakily and staggered to his feet.
Have we still got time? He croaked.
We'll have to have, smiled Chris grimly, and led them into the ghostly outline of the building. You have been listening to The Heaven Field. For more information, downloads, and artwork, visit theheavenfield.com.